Pastor Coles, who's speaking tonight, wears three hats. Sometimes, well, maybe not all at once. The first hat is as a lecturer, senior lecturer in neurology at Cambridge University, where he lectures on neurology, and he also runs a research group running clinical trials. His second hat is as a doctor. He's a clinical neurologist in Addenbrookes Hospital in Cambridge and in Peterborough. And his third hat is as a vicar. He was ordained in 2009 and is a curate, part-time curate, in St Andrew's Church. This is a somewhat unusual role for somebody to have all these hats, and that's the reason why we asked Alistair to come and speak to us today. He's got some extremely interesting insights into neurology and faith. So if any of that introduction was wrong, he can now correct.
Thank you very much. So let's just check that you can see and hear. How is that? Okay. So about a year ago, I gave a talk, and at the end of it, I was walking out behind two ladies, one of whom said to the other, "I didn't understand a word of that." And her companion said, "But at least he finished on time." I've taken this very much to heart, that I know how I can satisfy at least 50% of any audience. So the schedule is this, that I plan to talk for half an hour plus a little bit, with a couple of slots of test of faith, and then it really very much is open to you to ask questions or make comments. My personal goal for this evening is to trigger some discussions, perhaps tonight, but perhaps even more importantly, discussions in your home or your workplace, if you're a person of faith, in your place of worship, in your community, and I would feel extremely pleased if I've achieved that with a few people, triggered some discussions and raised some issues. So what I'm going to do is tell you a story and then describe to you three experiments which I think speak to some of the interesting things that neuroscience can contribute to discussions around faith. And then to tell you about two experiments that I'm going to do to show you the sort of way in which I'm thinking. And I have no results of these, haven't started them. And then I'm going to finish with a word on reductionism. And if I have a sort of party political manifesto tonight, it is to let you know how I feel about the way that neuroscience is used as the new form of reductionism. So I think in the past, we had evolution and we had genetics, and now neuroscience, it seems, explains all. And I have some comments to make about that. Now, I don't get paid any money if material from Test of Faith gets sold. So you don't need to misinterpret me when I say I think it's excellent material. I really encourage you to buy it, borrow it, steal it, whatever, however you can come across it, and use it in your local church or place of worship or your workplace. I've been saying this for a while, so I am going to do it in my workplace in the autumn, just otherwise it's a bit, I lack integrity that time if I keep advocating that. So please have a look at that material. And please also have a look at the Faraday Institute website, because apart from anything else, there is fantastic material to download in the form of podcasts of talks and things like that. And I have about 20 hours of lectures sitting on my iPhone, admittedly as yet unlistened to, but it makes me feel great to know that it's there. Yeah. Okay. So Let me just tell you how it is that I got into this with a little story. So Ruth's very kind about the things that I do. The key thing about having different things is, isn't it, that people never quite know where you are. So you can be sitting at home and people are imagining that you're in these other places doing great things while you're just watching DVDs or whatever. So that's a little tip. So I was minding my own business, walking along the corridors of Addenbrooke Hospital one day, when a colleague came up to me and said, "You believe in God, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, we need you to come see a patient who is refusing to see anyone unless they have a faith in God." Okay? So it's not a usual request, but anyway, so off I go and go to the outpatients department, where I sit down to meet this woman in my 12-minute allocated slot, and 2.5 hours later, I'm still there talking to her with a queue of irritated people outside. So here's the story. This is a lady whose name I could tell you, and she's given me permission to tell you this story, but I'm not going to because I think that's slightly weird, frankly. But she's very keen for this story to be popularised. She's in her middle age. Her profession is as a theologian. And in particular, she's a theologian who is called upon to test the truth of miracles on behalf of the Catholic Church. That's one of the things she does. So when people see a vision, or when there's a miraculous healing, she gets involved as one of many in deciding whether or not this is credible. She did not want to come see a doctor. She was only there because she'd been made to come by the religious community in which she lived. Because that community were getting increasingly concerned that there was something radically wrong with this theologian. And this is her story. When she was a teenager, she suddenly experienced attacks where God would speak to her. Out of the blue, without warning, she would suddenly feel at peace, calm, as though she was on an ocean, with the sense of goodness and peace around her, which she interpreted as God speaking to her. And these would last for seconds. And then they would go. And there seemed to be no rhyme or reason to them, until an unpleasant encounter with some pornography induced one of these attacks, which she felt was a divine gift to allow her to overcome her feelings. God had given her a sense of peace in a context where she was very troubled. And that led her to a very firm faith. And she's continued to experience these divine encounters more and more frequently and longer and longer. One which particularly began to worry people occurred while she was on a train. She has very little recollection of it, except that she ended up in prison in Cardiff, which was not her intended destination. And it turns out what had happened was that her behaviour had become increasingly erratic on the train, and the police had been called and she taken to prison. It was decided that this was some sort of a blip or whatever, and no more legally was taken forward. But her attacks or these divine encounters became longer and longer, and she went missing for a few days. And when she returned, she didn't know where she was, except that she was with a person of the opposite gender, and it seemed an inappropriate relationship had been formed. And this was extremely difficult for the context in which she lived, which was within a type of religious community. In fact, she was ejected from the community. So why should she be seeing a neurologist? Well, there is a type of epileptic seizure which have now been called Dostoevsky seizures, because Dostoevsky writes about them, amongst other places, in The Idiot, where the central character, Prince Myshkin, has epileptic seizures. And in the book, Dostoevsky writes through Prince Myshkin that just before the actual epileptic convulsion, suddenly Prince Myshkin's brain seems to catch fire. All his doubts and worries seem composed in a twinkling, culminating in a great calm, full of sense and harmonious joy and hope, and a blinding inner light flooded his soul. The reason why Dostoevsky was able to write so beautifully about these was because he himself experienced these events. He himself had epilepsy, and just before the convulsion, he experienced these things. And he says later on in an autobiography, "You have no idea, you who do not have epilepsy, what joy we epileptics experience just before a seizure." This experience, which has been documented now probably for centuries, began to be investigated by the great Canadian neurosurgeon called Wilder Penfield, who used to legitimately operate on awake patients and stimulate their brains because he was working out how far he could resect part of the brain without causing too much damage. And this is a procedure that goes on to this day. So it's a legitimate exploration of stimulating the cortex of the awake human brain and seeing what happens. And when Wilder Penfield stimulated a certain part of the brain, the awake patient in the operating theatre would say, "I feel as though a light has come into the room," or "I feel a sense of calm, I feel there is someone here in the operating theatre who cares about me, who loves me." And some people went on and said that they felt that God was in the operating theatre, or Mary, or some other figure. And when the electricity was cut off, that was it. And this has been documented time and time again. And the particular part of the brain where you can elicit these, what have been called numinous feelings, is the temporal lobe. And I've shown it there. So what do we make of information like that? And one of the important questions to ask when people like me tell you stories like this is, so what? So what? What significance does that have for me? Well, one person who has said so what, and has answered that question in this context, is a character called Michael Persinger, who has, from that information, made the hypothesis that all religious experience is due to many epileptic seizures in the temporal lobe. And as proof of this, he's devised this motorcycle helmet with the electrical wires over the temporal lobe. And he puts subjects in a room and puts a helmet on and delivers small electric currents across the temporal lobe. And in what he describes as susceptible people will induce feelings of the divine. And Richard Dawkins very famously put that motorcycle helmet on, and to the disappointment of both of them, nothing happened. So this is his answer to the so what question. Because people with epilepsy experience this, then that experience is always due to epilepsy. And this is, in my opinion, a false move, a false use of reductionism, and I'm going to come back to this, but just let me play you a little clip from the material that we offer. See if I can get this right.
across my mouth. So. I've got a paddock. Have faith.
Any neuroscientist knows how much our biology determines our behaviour. For centuries, some philosophers have concluded we're just sophisticated machines. Professor Bill Newsom is a neurobiologist at Stanford University. He thinks differently.
I have a lot of problem with saying that any high-level behavior is just biochemistry. I don't like the word just. In some ways, we could say that the camera that I'm looking into right now is just metal and glass and plastic. And that would be a true statement, but it misses the point. The secret to the camera is not the materials, the individual materials that go into it. It's how it's organized, it's the human purpose for which it's made, it's the function that gets captured as the camera is used. A camera is so much more than just the metal that goes into it. Now, in some sense, the brain and our behavior, you could say it's just biochemistry because the brain is totally made up of biochemical molecules. But it would be making the same mistake that it is to say that a camera is just glass and plastic and metal. I think it is a true statement, but it's an impoverished statement. It does not capture the richness of the reality and the levels of understanding that we want to have about the camera. And it does not capture the levels of understanding that we want to have about the brain and behavior in particular.
Okay, so that's a little introduction to the idea of the limits of reductionism, and that's going to be where I end in about 20 minutes, so just hold that thought. But now I want to Now I want to describe to you three experiments that have been done, which I think are interesting, and they nuance my understanding of my faith. They may be of no interest to you, that's fine. But a question that people have been asking for a long time is religious belief something special? Is it different from secular belief? And is belief different from disbelief? So if I say that I believe in God, is that fundamentally different from saying I believe there is no God? And I've heard many atheists say there is, and whereas other people have, there's a standard argument, isn't there, that atheism is a form of faith, it's just another belief. So one way of getting at this is to say, how does our brain handle these different things? And this is an experiment that was done by Sam Harris, who is one of the new atheists, if you like. But the beauty of science is, provided he's done the science properly, which I think he has, we can choose to interpret this however we like, can't we? That's the beauty of science. So here's his experiment. He takes individuals who are either signed up Christians or signed up atheists. He puts them in a scanner and he asks them a series of four questions, and then a little later another four questions, and they all take the same format. The first question would be answered yes by the Christian, no by the atheist, and the second question would probably be answered no by the Christian and yes by the atheist, and the third question would probably be answered no by both, yes by both, and the fourth would be no by both. Okay, so it's quite a nice design. It's a 2x2, 4x4, however you look at it, and the idea is to repeatedly ask these questions and to look at the activity of the brain, and in particular which brain pathways are being used in each of these different contexts, and you can begin to tease out the elements of saying that I believe something to be true, which would be the Christian saying the biblical God does exist and the atheist saying the biblical God is a myth. Those are both positive belief statements, same as them both saying Santa Claus is a myth. So all of that would be a positive belief, wouldn't it? A disbelief would be the atheist saying, no, the biblical God does not really exist. or a Christian saying, no, the biblical God is not a myth. So you can separate out belief and disbelief, religious and secular. Okay? So what do we see? Well, the first thing that is really interesting is if you just take all the belief statements and look at which parts of the brain are active during them, and then look at all of the disbelief statements and look at which parts are active, and then you subtract one from the other. I would have thought, my prior hypothesis would be, that for me to say, I believe God exists, is exactly the same, as far as my brain is concerned, as an atheist saying, I believe God does not exist. I would have thought they were the same sort of things. Well, madam, you're right, and I was wrong. Because...
By instinct, I wouldn't.
By instinct. Well, here's your instinct on a scan. So, if they were the same, they would cancel out. But instead, here we have a part of the brain that is very active when you're making an assertion of your belief that is not active when you're asserting a disbelief. And it doesn't matter whether this is religious, whether you're Christian, atheist, or whether it's about Santa Claus, or about whether eagles exist, it doesn't matter. The brain pathways for asserting belief are different from asserting disbelief. Now that, to me, is very interesting. It's also interesting that the brain pathways are much more rapid when you're asserting a belief, and it takes a lot longer to assert a disbelief. It's as though when you're asserting a disbelief, you have to do some checks. But if you're asserting a belief, it's part of your identity. It's rapid. It's readily available to you. So I don't think atheists saying they don't believe in God is the same thing as me saying I believe in God, at least as far as my brain is concerned. And that's been an interesting nuance for me. So I don't say that atheism is a form of faith, in the same way that I have a form of faith. Just a little nuance. Okay. Now here's another thing, same experiment. This is now saying, let's take the response to statements about religion, the angels, versus the response to the secular propositions about eagles. And is there any difference? In the first, the top panel, we're saying what's special about making a religious statement that is not found in a non-religious statement, and the bottom panel is the converse. What's special about a non-religious statement that isn't in a religious statement as far as our brain is concerned? And the first thing to say is they're different, aren't they? You can see that when we make religious statements, and this can be, as a Christian or as an atheist or whatever, we're involving quite a wide area of our brain. When we're making a statement about eagles, we're involving one or two rather discrete areas. Now here, you have to believe me when I say this, is that I've seen these pictures before. Okay? And this is one of the problems of this sort of experiment. Because the experimenter said, I've seen this before and I will now tell you what it shows. That actually isn't science, is it? It's called reverse inference and it's dodgy. But the non-religious statements seem to be using brain pathways that are used to bring back memories of facts. So it's the left temporal lobe, left frontal lobe, storage of simple facts of everyday life. So it's about eagles, I know about eagles, that's it. It's about, it's about books, novels, I know about them, that's easy. Okay? Now the pattern in the religious statements is much more complicated. It doesn't look like you're retrieving knowledge, it looks like you're resolving conflict. And in another set of experiments that Sam Harris did, where he had a third arm of uncertainty, and here the question might be something like, Jesus says 1,472 words in the gospel, right? And for a moment we're all a bit stunned, unless we're Baptists, because we know. But for a moment we're a bit stunned, and we're uncertain. Okay. Now that looks like a resolution. So Sam Harris would say, and I agree, this is resolving conflict and uncertainty. So it's a different process. Okay. So how does that help me? Well, in my encounters with individuals who are on their faith journey, I routinely see conflict. And I identify with it in myself. That saying that we believe in God does feel very different from saying we believe that eagles fly. It feels very different. You feel as you say it that you have some reservations or some concerns. And in people who are going, most people, not everyone, most people will admit to having some difficulties, having some reservation. And this is as though they're calculating every time whether God does exist or not. But they're going through this process. And that seems to me to ring true. So I find that helpful. It's a little nuance. Okay, experiment number two, which I think is the most important study in the imaging of the religious brain. I'm a huge fan of this study, and I think has profound importance. And it deals with this basic question: is religion special to humans? Now, language is special to humans. There'll be people here who want to speak out for monkeys and so on, but you're in the minority. And the human brain structurally demonstrates that we have evolved language as a special tool of being human. We have a hugely expanded set of areas that you can barely see in monkeys that are structurally enormous in our brain to do with language. And language is a special function that has been bolted on, or grafted on, or however you like to put it, in our evolutionary path. And you can look at a human brain and a monkey brain and say that is radically different. So the question is this: is religion the same? Does the brain have special slots, a special place for dealing with God that has evolved since monkeys and marks us out as being the only thing that can talk to God? Now that is surely a profound question. And every so often you'll see on the BBC Science website or in your Sunday newspaper, you'll see, is there a God spot, which is the kind of shortened version of what I've just said. Is there something special in our brain, the God spot, that deals with God, that only we have? Those areas, I should have said, Broca and Wernicke's areas, are the areas of our brain that deal with language. So this experiment is a study of just 26 people, all of whom have a faith. As it happens, a Christian faith, but I don't think that's terribly relevant. And in passing, I'd just say most of the science in this area is on people with a Christian faith, and that, you know, that's something we could discuss maybe. And the first step in this experiment is to ask these 26 people hundreds of questions, literally hundreds of questions about their experience of God, their belief, their practice, whether they pray, whether they go to church, how often they read the Bible, hundreds of questions, and then use a particular statistical technique to try and reduce the variability of these 26 individuals so that you can plot each individual on a map, which looks like that. So this is a three-dimensional map, as it were, and this statistical technique says I can reduce these array of answers in these 26 people down to a point that's described as somewhere on the dimension of these three. So, in dimension one, some people might say, God is with me every day. I feel God's presence with me as I make every decision. He is close, he's involved in my life, or she is close. involved in my life, cares about. That'd be one extreme. Another extreme might be God is distant, doesn't care, has created us and left us alone. And everyone, they argue, you can plot at some point along that scale. Dimension two is people who say, God always loves me. Unconditionally, I feel love and peace from God. I feel nothing else. Other people might say, God hates me because I'm sinful. And some people might plot themselves somewhere along that dimension. And then a final dimension is, how do I know about God? Where do I learn about God? Some people might say, well, I study theology 8 hours a day. I read books, I listen to lectures, and I'm a very word-based, knowledge-based person. Other people might say, I wait for the Holy Spirit. I just experience everything, and what I don't experience is not real. Now, you can, as it were, argue with this, but for the sake of the experiment, just run with it a bit. So each of these 26 individuals can be plotted along those three dimensions for the sake of this experiment. Okay. And then the subjects are put into these scanners and they are asked hundreds and hundreds of questions and they give graded responses. This takes hours for each individual, several days coming back, many months, and then the outcome of it all are these statistical maps. And the top map here is the map that says wherever you lie on the dimension of God's perceived level of involvement, either very, very close to me or indifferent and uncaring, the variability in responses in that dimension can be summed up by brain activity in these pathways. So it doesn't say which represents which, that's not the point, as it were. It says, if you're in the zone of thinking about whether God's involved with me or not, then you will be activating these pathways. Dimension number two, if you're thinking about whether God hates me or loves me or somewhere in between, you'll be activating these pathways. And if you're asked where does your religion come from, as it were, you'll be activating these pathways. And this is quite a nice example because we recognise bits of this. So if you're a very word, knowledge-based person, you'll be accessing the temporal lobe. If you're more visual, it'll be occipital lobe. If it's more integrative, the parietal lobe and so on. We can follow that. Now here's the thing. And you have to believe me. I've seen this before. There is nothing special about this, because these are exactly the same pathways that I use when I look at you, madam, and I am wondering whether you're involved in my life or not. I don't think you are. And when I look at you, sir, for dimension number two, when I'm thinking, does he like me or not like me, or is he getting bored? And then I think, does he think that I like him? Or does he think that I think that he likes me? And this, to give it its technical name, is theory of mind. Okay? So this is me trying to work out the minds and the emotions of other people around me. And we use it all the time, don't we? You know, when I get into the door at the end of the evening, I see my wife, within an instant, I know that she's furious with me. I often don't know why, but she is. Or, you know, I know that it's, and we use that all the time. And when we're first meeting people, or first dating someone, or first starting at a job with a boss or whatever, there's a lot of energy, isn't there, in working out what does he think of me, what does he think I think of him, and all of that stuff. And here's the point. Within the limits of this experiment, this is telling us that we think of God as we think of another person, and there is no difference. There's nothing special about our brains when we think of God. Now that seems to me to be a profound conclusion, if correct. So for me, let me tell you what I take from that, and you can disagree with me. I mean, one of the things that I take from that, which annoys theologians, is to say, well, there are some higher animals that can do a limited sense of this. So my dog does know what I think, doesn't it? And if you've got dogs, not hamsters, but dogs, can tell what you think a bit, can't they? There's some theory of mind going on there. And so the question is, this allows the possibility for animals to have some concept, something like God. And that always upsets theologians. But here, this is good, isn't it? This is scientists coming and saying, well, look, have you thought about this? Because the science is saying it's possible. And that, I think, is the good dialogue that we should be having. But the other thing is that this makes sense to me of a lot of people's struggles with God. And the advice that's often given, which is to treat God as a friend, as a partner, as someone to be with you alongside. There are various phrases that use them. Some phrases you may like, some you may not. But the Song of Solomon in the Bible is all about this. Okay? And there are bits in the Bible that suddenly make sense to me, that we can be intimate with God. I'm sorry to talk about the Bible specifically, but that's all I know about in terms of sacred texts. I'm not meaning to exclude other religions in this. So that's what I take from this. I think that when people say they have a personal experience of God, that is very real and true as far as their brain is working. I suppose another way of looking at this is, well, what would you expect? What would you actually expect? Some people expect, when you image the brain of people experiencing God, to see nothing. Some people expect that because they think that somehow experiencing God bypasses normal everyday life. And some people get very upset when shown scans like this because they think the brain is matter. Maybe they think it's sinful, dirty matter, I'm not sure, and somehow should be left to one side when experiencing God. Some people in audiences like this have told me that. I think that's wrong. I think science tells us that isn't true. I think the brain is intimately involved in a way which we'll come on to in a second. Okay, so just one more experiment. And this is an old classic. Free will. Do we truly have free will or not? And the experiment that has upset a lot of people over the years, although to be honest it's never worried me, is this. So this is Benjamin Libet's experiment. So this is a subject, and he or she is allowed to press a button whenever he or she wants. So this is free will. It's not very exciting, free will. So you can press the button whenever you want. And the person is able to look at this clock. So there's the clock. And this red dot goes round in a regular way. And the idea of the experiment is you say to the subject, whenever you want, at your discretion, press the button. Only the one thing you must remember is where the red dot was when you decided to press the button. Okay? It's not that you have to say, I'll press a button in 15 seconds. No. You go whenever you want, but when you make that decision, you press the button. Okay? And at the same time, the electrical activity over the scalp of the brain is recorded. And so what do you see? So these are individual traces. So these are subjects. Three different subjects, and these are different trials, different events, and the red line is where is the time at which the subject is conscious of having decided to move. Okay, so wherever it was on that clock is now. I decide to move now, and here's the recordings of activity over the brain, so it's no surprise that after that event you see increased activity because you've decided to move and you press the button. However, the thing that's upset some people over the years is that you see increased activity before the event. This is called the readiness potential, technically. So the idea is that before you're even conscious of having decided to press that button, your brain knows about it before you. You are under control of your brain. Your conscious self is just a puppet. You have no free will, is the conclusion that some people have drawn from Benjamin Libet's experiment. Personally, I'm much more relaxed about it. Like my wife, when we go to a party, if my conscious self is a bit late on the act, I'm not too bothered. We still intended to come. I think that where people run into trouble is they think that their conscious self is the only thing they have. So really what you're doing is denying intentionality of your unconscious self. I allow that my unconscious brain or bits of my brain can work and do things without it ever hitting my consciousness. So getting ready to prepare a movement so that when I decide to do it, as it were, that everything works out seems to me an entirely reasonable way for the brain to behave. But let's see what someone very clever says.
I think there's just a fundamental human experience, fundamental being the human person, but that we are creatures of choice and moral responsibility. Of course, I know that philosophers can deny that, but nobody outside their studies lives as if they were an automata of one sort or another. You only have to throw a glass of water in the face of a reductionist philosopher to see that that's the case.
You make the argument that in reality we have no choice, we have no control over our actions. It's all physics in the brain, it's all emotions of ours. But I don't believe that that's true. I believe that all of our choices have mechanisms underlying them. If my brain were not active, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be capable of making a choice. So the brain mechanisms are necessary to enable choice. And our choices are constrained. I can't choose to play golf like Tiger Woods. I can't choose to play basketball like Michael Jordan. There are certain things I cannot choose to do because of the biology of my body and the biology of my brain. But I think that within large arenas of behavior, we really do have the ability to make meaningful choice. And how that gets reconciled with neurobiology at a mechanistic level is still quite mysterious, and we don't know the answers to that. But I think it's a very, very important question for all of us to reason about in the future, scientists and non-scientists alike.
In the end, I think all these things are promises and not threats, though of course they may lead to perplexities. And we have to be careful not to allow reductionist interpretations of what's going on to just take over. Neuroscience isn't going to tell us all about the human person. It's going to tell us interesting, important things. We're embodied people. How our bodies work is important. But it's not the whole story about us. We're more than computers made of meat or something like that.
Now, I'm watching time, so I'm going to skip on. So let me tell you about something that I'm really interested in doing. So this is the future. And then we'll be about 5 minutes, and then we're going to be done. So I'm a neurologist and I'm interested in people with brain diseases, and there's one particular type of dementia where the frontal lobes are specifically damaged first. And sometimes you get one frontal lobe damaged first before another. And the advantage, if you don't mind me putting it like this, because it's tragic for the people involved, but the advantage of this experiment of nature or experiment of disease is that we get to see what happens if you lose the function of one frontal lobe. So, this is an artist who developed just such a problem. And this is a picture the artist drew of the Rialto Bridge when he was well. He then developed frontotemporal dementia affecting the left frontal lobe, which meant that he was having increasing difficulties with speech and with language, with writing, with reading. And yet his art flourished. At this point, he was unable to speak, or read, or write. And some people have said that his paintings just got better and better. And this is 9 months before he died, completely unable to communicate using language in any form. So I'm not an artist, but I do recognise there is a change of quality that you could describe as increased stylized. It's increasingly mannered, and perhaps it's more competent in some way. I'm not sure, and that is his final picture of the Rialto Bridge before he died. So, why do I raise this? Well, Bruce Miller, who's the neurologist who looked after this patient, has described a syndrome where, as people lose function of the left frontal lobe, new creative and musical talents emerge. As though they were always dormant and had been suppressed in health. And suddenly, because part of the brain is dysfunctioning, are allowed to emerge. Now that is a very provocative belief, isn't it? Now Bruce Miller has described this for music and art, but the experiment that we're about to start in Cambridge is to question whether people have a religious flowering in this context. And we have some evidence to suggest that's the case. So it may be that in health, our brain is the site of a war or conflicts between different appetites. It may be, for instance, as a hypothesis, that every single person has a strong religious appetite, which is being suppressed in health by another part of the brain, not allowed to flower. Now that is hugely provocative, isn't it, as an idea, and we could go with that a long way, but we're not going to. And I'm actually going to skip a few slides because I want to leave time for discussion, and I just have one point to make. So this is about reductionism. And I have to be honest with you and say that as I've started to think about this, I have had times when it's been a real problem for me that it seems you can explain human behaviour by the activity of a certain part of the brain. And that has at times undermined for me the integrity of my emotions, my beliefs, my experiences. I've kind of moved on from that, and the reason I've moved on from that is because of this chair. And if you think this is simplistic, that will just give you some insight into me. So this is a chair. So my question to you is, how do you describe this chair? How can you most satisfactorily describe this chair? Okay. So here's one way you could do it. This is a very functional description of this chair. You could say what it's made of. It's made of wood. You could say, well, wood is made up of something, and we could look down a microscope. I don't know if you've ever done that, but this is wood under a microscope. And isn't that beautiful? It's stunning, isn't it? And those aren't ordinary colours, I'm afraid. That's stained. But just in passing, we're just taken aback by the beauty of something like that. And then we say, well, actually, we know that those fibres are made of something, and we can analyse them, and turns out that cellulose is the main component of most types of wood, and here is cellulose. So, how do you best describe this chair? What's the most satisfactory description for it? Well, I think it depends a bit on who you are and what you want. I mean, if you've been asked to repair this chair, then you probably want to know what sort of wood it is, don't you? And that would be a very satisfactory explanation. And you want to know who designed it and what manner in which to do it. If you were a chemist, I suppose this would be your thing, wouldn't it? You'd get really excited about just what proportion of cellulose was in this chair. Now, it's absolutely necessary for this chair to exist that cellulose exists, just as it's absolutely necessary for us to have a brain that has neurons in it, that has neurotransmitters. There is no question of that. You can't say cellulose is irrelevant. It's absolutely fundamental. But is it the entire explanation for my chair? Now, I'm a bit like the chemist here as far as the brain's concerned. I mean, I do get excited, metaphorically, with how much cellulose is in that chair. But you might not. And you might say, I'm completely uninterested in that. And it may be that one conclusion from this evening is say, well, frankly, I'm just not interested in the brain and religion. And actually, I wouldn't be disappointed in that at all. Because I think in saying that, you've come to the grips, to the limits. You have recognised just how limited the useful information for our everyday lives can emerge from brain studies. But here's my point. This chair belongs to my mother-in-law. She gave it to me. It was made by her grandfather. It was made for her father, who died when my mother-in-law was 4. He was killed in Singapore. So when I look at this chair, to be honest with you, how much cellulose is in it is frankly irrelevant. This chair has a story. It's a story about relationships. It's a story about history. It's a story about a present. It's a story about a blighted life. It's a story about my family. And that can't be replaced by another chair that's identical. And I'm being honest with you in saying that this chair has helped me to see the limits of reductionism. I think it is perfectly acceptable to say that everything we believe and experience requires a brain. But the brain is not the full and adequate explanation for it. So on that point, I'm going to stop and invite questions.
This one has a new battery.
I just got it. Yeah, I'll repeat it if it's not clear.
You know the one you do with the experiment where it showed that the brain decided the decision before they
yes.
made it?
Yes.
Yes, I just want to say that
it works in both directions, doesn't it? Yeah, so conscious.
I'm saying about the brain control, because
yeah.
I was stopping the brain.
Yeah.
So is it proving or disproving a bit about that the brain controls us?
Yeah, so I don't think our brain does control us. I was being a bit sarcastic, and I apologise if I was misleading there. So I think is our brain and our bodies set some limits around which we can do. So some of you may be fantastic musicians. I'm completely incompetent. My brain will not allow me to be a good musician, I promise you. I tried all those years with this dreadful violin teacher called Mrs. Hedger. we both suffered for 11 years and we finally had to call a halt to that. Some people would have flourished in that environment because their brains would have accommodated. So I use this as a description. So my brain has imposed limits on what I am capable of doing. But I can act within those limits. I can express my free will and I can impose myself on my brain, if you like to use your language, within those limits. Not sure if that's clear. But
You showed us pictures of the scans of the 26 Christians who have been asked questions about God, and that displayed, as I understood it, that the evidence that showed they thought of God as a person.
Yes.
If they'd been thinking about inanimate objects,
yes,
would that have displayed activity in different pathways?
Yes.
Part one of the question, and therefore part two of the question. Just wondered what would happen if the questions had been towards people whose experience and understanding of faith was not of a personal God, but of something a bit vaguer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the second question is excellent, and there is no data. So, unfortunately, science is very biased towards people from the Judaic faith who believe in a personal God or a single personal God. So I can't answer that second question. In terms of how do brains think about inanimate objects, well, adults think very differently, but children will infer causality and will infer agency in inanimate objects. In other words, they will think that things have minds, and their brains will behave in that way. And I mean, if you've had children, that's not a big surprise, is it? You know, if something happens, they assume that someone has done something to it, or the you know, my son tells me that when he drops plates, the plate jumped out of his hand, you know, like that. And you can see that. So one of the things that we do as we become adults is learn that inanimate objects don't do that. So we don't use theory of mind for inanimate objects, and so you would see a different scale.
Yes.
Shout out, sir, I'll repeat it.
I know that why questions are quite difficult,
yeah,
but is there any biological advantage or any purpose to one lobe suppressing the other lobe? Is there any reason why that might be happening?
Well, I really don't know the answer to that. I mean, there's part of me that wants to say, actually, that isn't a big surprise, because that is just the brain substrate for the experience that we all have. That as we go through life, society imposes on us restrictions and we impose on ourselves restrictions. So that, I mean, I have appetites that I try and repress, and society certainly wants to see repressed. And that may well be manifest in the way my brain is organised. Is that? So I think that may be all there is to it. I suppose my interest comes from the question is every human being born religious and then suppressed? Or are there some people born incapable of a religious appetite, just like I have no musical competence? And people get a bit edgy when you start raising these things, but I think that's where it's going, that sort of question. Do you want to shout out in the green there? Yes.
So where people maybe have been tested before, I guess you can't really say, oh, that person might convert, so let's do a study of them. But are there studies of what happens to your brain if you have a profound religious experience that then leads to faith from no faith?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that there are exactly. The question was, are there any studies of what happens during conversion when you go from a state of having no faith to a state of faith? Can you see some correlate of that in the brain? So I'll say two things that speak to that a little bit. So it's quite clear that some people with temporal lobe epilepsy who have these experiences will convert, and convert to a faith that, from all external appearances, seems to have integrity. And the theologian that I described to you will say, even though you tell me it's epilepsy, I don't care, because it's God speaking to me. The second point which you might have been asking is, if you see people who are very, very good at religion and have been doing it for a long, long time, have their brains developed in a way that's different from those who are very, very good at having no faith? Is there some fundamental difference that you can see as a result of conversion? And so far the answer appears to be no. There's no change in the brain structure. So far, but these are not well researched areas. Oh, so
you talked about the appetite for religion.
Yes.
And by religion, I think
The only thing I'd say is probably brain scans are not going to help you with that. It's just too fine a resolution a question, but I completely agree with it. And I have nothing more to say on that. So, did St. Paul have epilepsy?
Yes.
If he did have epilepsy, did that mean it's all rubbish? We should tear up Corinthians? You may be very keen to tear up Corinthians. So I think there are two things to say here. One is we'll never know, so is it useful to answer the question? But that's a bit of a negative. Actually, I think the interesting thing that emerges from my talking with this theologian is I think St. Paul might say it doesn't matter. So let me give you an example of that. Who's the... Karen Armstrong. Do people know Karen Armstrong?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who is a theologian, at the moment doesn't have an Orthodox faith. Is that fair to say? Karen Armstrong had epilepsy. When she was in convent, this is written up in the narrow staircase, I think it's called, she was given anticonvulsant drugs, she no longer had seizures, and she left the convent, and her faith, either she lost it or changed radically. She will still say that the thing that gave her the closest intimation, to use her word, intimation of heaven and hell, was her experiences during her seizures. Even though she knows that they were an artifact of a disease. She would still say that. And she would still say that what brought her into the realm of theology was the experience she had during her seizures. So I would say to you, whether St. Paul had epilepsy or not, Corinthians is still valid. You've still got to grapple with it. It may have been motivated by experiences in seizures, maybe, but that is the working out of a rational theology in the face of experiences. Is that a reasonable response?
I think that when you go to psychiatry, you could say there are people who, and even when they're treated schizophrenics, they will say there was something about that psychotic experience that had deep meaning.
Yes, definitely. Yes.
Someone would recognize it as a state of a pathological mind.
Yes.
It's a question of whether there's any external meaning in reality.
Yes.
Or whether it's simply a manifestation of a biological process.
Yes, I agree. So it's a good question. So if someone has a schizophrenia or epilepsy, it leads them to experiences which we would all say, as it were, are an artifact. But they then continue to say they're significant. What meaning does that for anyone else? It can be fine for the individual. What meaning for anyone else? So. I think what's quite helpful here is to look at what the, if you don't mind me being Christian for a moment, because that's all I know, is if you look what the scriptures say. And the scriptures, you know, are very steady and rational about testing people out. It's no good to stand up in a church in Corinth and blabber away in tongues. That's no good. You've got to be interpreted, it's got to make sense, it's got to be coherent, other people have got to witness to it. There are all these checks and balances. Which St. Paul passes, I think. Your psychotics may pass. So I would say that it built into Christianity, at least, and maybe the other religions, is an understanding that people can be wildly off the mark and feel themselves right, and that there are ways of testing that. So.
You mentioned speaking in tongues.
Yeah.
Is there a new. Any investigations about the use of the brain while people are speaking in tongues?
Yeah.
Because I've heard people saying that actually when you're speaking in praying in tongues, you're using a completely different section of the brain to the part of the brain that you would use when you were talking rationally.
I'm afraid that isn't the case.
It's not the
case. No. I'm afraid it's not. So as far as the resolution of brain imaging goes, talking in tongues looks like talking through your shopping list. I don't think that means that talking in tongues has no value. I'm not saying that, but I'm afraid it's the same. So does getting religion have survival advantage in our evolutionary process? And this is not something I know a lot about, but is a big concern of some of the lectures on the Fowler Institute website. You can argue it both ways. And the only comment I would make is, if you prove that religion has a survival advantage in evolution, so what? You see, some people say evolution has a survival advantage, therefore religion is rubbish. It's just an artifact introduced to promote our survival. But I would say, as someone with faith, bring it on. My religion and my faith does give me a survival advantage. I'm quite happy for that to be part of my evolutionary story. Do you see what I mean? So you can argue it either way, but for me, the big question is, so what? And it doesn't bother me. Move on quickly.
A link to that. One hears various things over the radio that people with a religious faith are more likely to recover from serious illness. People with a religious faith are less likely to recover from serious illness.
Yeah.
Do you have any information about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I really don't like, and you see it in some forms of evangelism, is saying, if you become a Christian, you'll be healthier, you'll live longer, you'll be married for longer, your life's going to be fantastic.
Yes.
And I think that's an abuse of studies which show that there is an association in America with being a conservative Christian and being more healthy and living longer. But there's also a big association with not smoking. And confounders like that. And I'm yet to be convinced that the element of having a faith has been teased out from many of these problems. So I'm very wary about that. Madam,
I've always had a fear of seizures and epilepsy.
Yes.
And that's partly from the Bible, where
yes.
God is casting out demons and everything.
Yeah.
And I've worked with people at an epilepsy school.
Yeah.
And I've always had a fear of it. And
yeah.
Tonight you've showed another side, which I didn't know about.
Yeah, thank you. Do you mind if I repeat that? Because it's quite, I think it's a very meaning. So the lady was saying that she has a fear of seizures, and certainly in the Bible you do read of people who exorcised of their epilepsy, demonized. The demons are taken out. So epilepsy is caused by demons and you need exorcism. And there's part of that in the Bible. There are people with epilepsy in the Bible in whom no demons are mentioned. It's not completely universal. The boy who falls in the fire can't speak after a seizure. There is definitely something special about epilepsy in our consciousness. It's partly because to witness a seizure is so horrible. And over the years it's been associated with the divine and with hell. It's been called the king's evil and so on. And it's a real problem for people who have epilepsy. It's a real problem. Very stigmatized still to this day. The only thing I'd say is that there is this undercurrent of people getting benefit from epilepsy. And you know that there's a small proportion of infants, who have no language, with epilepsy, who will hide their tablets and not take them. Because they experience some pleasure in their seizures. It's not common, maybe 5 to 10% feel pleasure from their seizures, and they hide their tablets. If you measure their blood levels, they don't take it. So there's that flip side. Ruth, we're going on to 9 o'clock, is that right?
Yeah.
So we've got a few more questions. So people who have
you, sir. I wonder if you could share your thoughts on the survival of consciousness after death and near-death experiences.
Yeah. So near-death experiences are actually, seem to me, pretty mundane. They're very stereotyped and almost entirely inexplicable to me as the sort of experiences you get when you lose oxygen supply to the brain and the parts that are last, the parts that are still awake, as it were, as you lose sight, tend to be those parts which report the blinding light, the tunnel, the funny noises and so on. Very stereotyped. And I personally don't read any great significance into them. I don't think we are conscious after death.
What I was thinking of was life after death. I mean, Paul said, if Christ be not raised, we are all we can be visited.
Yes.
So it's fundamental to his belief. How do you see it in your...
Yes. So here I go. I think we're dependent on a living brain to be who we are. And when our brain dies, that is it. We die. Everything goes. That's it. There is nothing ethereal left. And when the trumpets sound, we'll be given a new body and we will rise again. So what provides the integrity of ourselves in the intervening time? Well, it's the same integrity that's with my chair. When that chair is destroyed, it will still have been made by my wife's grandfather, and it would still have been given to her mother's father, who will still have died. That story will still be there, and that story will still live on. Speaking personally, I will still live on in the memory of God, and when I rise again with my new body, I'll be reunited into that relationship. And I believe there is a strand of biblical thought that would support that. But I'm not really here to discuss theology, just in the white shirt.
I'm wondering what a person of faith, what the community of faith could say to, could offer to people who say have autism, whose brains are neurological deficits, that says that sort of preclude them from experiencing about spiritually, people of Christian faith who
That's a fantastic question, so I'll just repeat it. So are there people whose brain can't do the sort of things I've shown? And a classic example which you brought up is people with autism. One of the things that people with autism can't do is me think what you're thinking of, me thinking of you. They just can't do that. So what is their experience of God?
And what can the community of faith offer to them?
So, I mean, here's what I say, and some people get upset by this. I think someone with autism will have an impoverished view of God compared to you or I. And their only hope is the grace of God to give them some other perspective on God. They'll never be able to understand us talking about God's intentionality. So to talk to someone with autism, if you have autism, so just for a moment, for me to say that, you know, God loves you and cares about may not be that meaningful, because you may not understand what that means. You've got no idea. For me to say, God will help you when you have a problem, that might be much more useful, because someone else can understand that. Do you see what I mean? And I think we've got to be really sensitive to this. And you take it to another extreme, you know, we all of us are oddballs, and our brains aren't quite right, all of us. And there may be some things about our faith, the communal faith, which we just can't get. And that's true, isn't it? If you're in a faith community, there'll be oddballs amongst you who just don't get the importance of, the creation. Or, you know, whatever it is that you're hung up on, there'll be some people from whom just don't get it. That's why it's so important to be in community. Right, one last question that has to be, so you've been really patient.
I'd like to come back to this issue of this point here, but my impression of 60 years of living in this country is that we're becoming decreasingly empathic, that we have more and more need for strictures and regulations about providing patients in hospital water with food. And I'm interested in the correlation between what I perceive to be an increase in dominance of the left hemisphere in policy and in stipulations coming from those who govern us, and that we need to have a movement, if you like, of those of us who are perhaps more right and spheric, to reintroduce empathy
know, in my hospital, we send a survey out to patients after they've been in hospital, ask them all sorts of questions, and it always comes back the same. It's really depressing. Individual people during their time have been fantastic, the care technically has been fantastic, but when they press their buzzer, no one came. Messages were left, but they weren't passed on. Just basic, simple acts of compassionate humanity seem to have left us by. And so I agree with you completely. How you get around this, I just, you know, I really don't know. It's a really tough call. And I think as part of a big society, people of faith can contribute to this in some way. But I am going to stop because I know half of you will be pleased if I stop.
Let's thank Alistair again for it.